Welcome to Everyone's a Critic Movie Review Podcast. I'm your co-host, Bob Zarrell. With me, as always, the professional film critic, Sean Patrick. Visit us at IHateCritics.net or on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. The handle's Critics Pod. Patreon.com/CriticsPod. Let me say that again, because that's a very important website. Patreon.com/CriticsPod is the best way to help support the podcast. And then we have the T Public page up in the right-hand corner of our website, IHateCritics.net. Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Alexa, Stitcher, YouTube. Subscribe to the show, rate and review the show. It also helps the podcast with the algorithms that are out there. How are you doing, Sean? I don't even know where to start. I ran through those faster than I normally do. And
say that again. I'm sorry. I missed that.
I run through those faster than I normally do. And normally, I guess I just jump to trailers. Anything? How's it going in the world of being quarantined or whatever we are, social distanced?
You know, it's pretty great, actually. I'm writing a book, which is, you know, because I'm more quarantined than most due to my health issues, and so I don't go anywhere. And I found my old MySpace blog. So like 10 years ago, like when MySpace was shutting down, they gave people the chance to download their blog. You could like download it before they just outright deleted it. And apparently at that time I did that. And what I found was a trove of reviews from 2004 to 2009 of like 500 reviews that I wrote that I've totally forgotten about, that I apparently had not written for any particular site at the time. I was writing them and then reading them on the radio. And so I find these 500 reviews and I'm like going through all these old, this old MySpace blog and transferring those to Google Docs so I can put them in my book. And it's like, it's this like having a bizarre conversation with myself. Did you know, Bob, that I loved Kingdom of the Crystal Skull? Loved it. 8 out of 10 stars.
I remember you liked it more than most when we half-assed talked about it.
I praised that movie up and down. Yeah, I had no memory of doing it. Not that I've ever said I don't think I've ever said I hated it, but
right.
I don't recall loving it as much as I did. I love that, and I hate the other Indiana Jones movies.
That's funny.
This is going to be the best time of my life once I get all this together and actually start the actual editing process of trying to, because apparently I've never in my life, Bob, known how to spell the word exercise. My entire life, I've never known how to spell that word.
I had the same problem with Rogue and Rouge.
You've demonstrated that more than once on the show, yeah.
Fucking Mission Impossible.
Yeah, I always spelled exercise EXC for some reason. I don't know where I got that from, but I apparently have been doing that for about 20 years or so.
Do you know when you stopped? But maybe you'll find out in the middle of this.
I think last week, I think.
That's funny. Oh, man. Yeah, that I still have access to my blog, and I'm petrified of even looking back. I can still have... Every now and then when I hear a song and I remember I reviewed the album, and I'll just get like feel gross about the way I reviewed it in a good, yeah. Like I'm positive about the comparisons I'll make. I'll maybe go over the top a couple times and I don't know. It just, I feel like a different person sometimes when Time Hop pops up and I'm looking even at my social media stuff, I'm just like, I put that out there. I mean, nothing really horrible, but just like, that's embarrassing. I would never say that today.
One thing I didn't keep from this was the actual, like, the regular everyday kind of personal blog posts, because I apparently, in 2004, I was apparently something of an incel before incels exist. I was awful. Not that I was, like, hateful to women, but, like, I didn't understand women in any way. Right. And I was there. You could sense a little bit of that bitterness that could have developed in the wrong way. And thankfully it didn't. Thankfully I met a beautiful woman who turned my life around and made me a better person at that time, because it was going the wrong direction in 2004.
Wow, that's funny the way you worded that. Yeah, I just, that's, I mean, we're going to get to a lot of this later on too, but man, your stuff's out there. When you write it down, people can find it. A lot of people find out the hard way.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Oh man, that's interesting though.
You got to do it, Bob. You got to go back through that stuff sometime. It's a trip.
The sad thing is I have a pretty good memory, and yeah, like
I fucking don't.
The main thing I like, there's this, I don't know why it popped in my head recently. Like literally as you, like a day before you told me you're writing the book, or at least I've known you've been working on it a while, but I know you spent a lot of time on it early this weekend or this week when I was writing. And literally like that day I was listening to Slipknot for whatever reason. And I remember reviewing this localish band and claiming the singer that was as good as Corey Taylor from Slipknot. And it just, I'm just like, people are going to read this and know I'm a total fraud. I mean, I was, but it's just like, why? It just gave me just made me feel gross, and I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't get rid of it.
There's this wonderful, YouTube guy, Quentin Reviews, who, he did this piece on The Simpsons and how the predictive ability of The Simpsons, and how, you know, the only reason The Simpsons have ever actually predicted anything is because they've done every story. Eventually, you're going to predict something. And I keep reading these old reviews going, I'm going to predict something in these reviews that's going to actually come true just because I've written so much.
That would be amazing.
Oh.
You're going to predict like the Marvel Universe before it happens.
Or just something. I'm going to catch myself saying something awful and get myself canceled from publishing it.
You're going to cancel yourself.
I'm going to cancel myself.
I can't read my own shit anymore.
Oh, all those things I said about Nicole Kidman back in the day. I was very attracted to her and I was not good at hiding it.
Yeah, there's, yeah. But
I mean, I just imagine for a moment the kind of criticism that Jim Ross gets today is what I would get from my Nicole Kidman reviews back in the day.
Yeah, I definitely, I think I might have a Connie Britton review in there from reviewing something she did. Maybe Nashville when it first came out. Anyway, let's move on to the show before we actually get ourselves canceled.
All right.
Let's start with trailers. We haven't done this in a while, but one of our favorite directors, if not favorite, you know, combined director, Denis Villeneuve, his trailer for Dune is out. What do you think?
Visually impressive, as we would expect from Denis Villeneuve. The cast is so incredible, you know, with Chalamet and Oscar Isaac and all those people. It looks spectacular. I really, really, really am looking forward to just that week, the opportunity to watch Dune again. And I especially want to watch the documentary Jodorowsky's Dune to see just how much of that, what of Jodorowsky's ideas influenced Villeneuve, because apparently there's some definite influence there. So I'm really excited about that. Okay. Mostly like everything around Dune is exciting, let alone the movie itself.
When we get to that week, can we do nothing else but that then? Because I'm not looking forward to watching David Lynch's Dune. It just seems like I remember when I first got into Lynch, I went and watched it. I'm just like, what the fuck is going on? And I haven't watched any documentaries on it. I know it's kind of a controversial movie, and people aren't, you know, they don't normally bring that movie up when they bring David Lynch up. it's not quite Bad Lynch, but it's somewhere in the middle, and I don't know. So I'm all game to do that episode, but do you like that movie, the Lynch version?
I don't honestly remember. It's been too long since I've watched it. I can't recall.
And I'll be honest, all I remember is Misery. I don't remember liking or hating it, just being like, Jesus, this isn't over yet. That said, I think this looks amazing.
Yeah.
It made me like, I think I would like a Star Wars if he directed it. You know what I'm saying? That's how good this
looks. That's quite a statement. That's quite a statement.
And I don't know when it's supposed to come out, but if this, you know, if he has an excuse to fail again financially, I mean, that's my would have been my big worry. Seeing this, I could see it actually doing really well because it does look pretty visually impressive. And without the like Blade Runner is kind of a niche thing. I know Dune is as well, but this looks like it could bring in that Lord of the Rings type crowd, Star Wars crowd. Maybe
there's like a cult out there, yeah, that has been dying to see Dune done right, I guess.
And I don't know how big that cult, but I'm hoping there's a broader. That's what I worry about. Like the Blade Runner cult wasn't big enough for Blade Runner. Although you look at LA right now, it looks a lot like Blade Runner 20.
It does.
But it looks freaking awesome, and like you said, the cast is amazing. I can't wait to see it. And I'm all game for that week to do whatever you want, Dune wise, documentaries, movies. But it might be
the only issue is going to be that I probably won't get to see Dune.
Right.
Unless I get a screener, then probably, which, you know, if it's in November, I might have it by then, such that would be helpful. But if I don't, then I probably won't be able to go to a theater for it.
Yeah, that would be the hard part, is you almost want to see it on a big screen, but at the same time, I just want to see it. I mean, everything he does is amazing. Arrival hasn't gotten any worse by being on TV versus
Arrival's just incredible. Yeah.
So I'm all in. It sucks that, I mean, I'm in a way it's good for him that he can afford to not make the money back if it isn't going to do well, because he's got the built-in excuse, but
right.
It looks impressive as hell. I did see a trailer for a movie called Freaky from the guys that did Happy Death Day. It looks kind. I mean, I think it looks fun. You know, it's putting it up next to Dune. It's like, why we even bother watching making movies like this? But it's Vince Vaughn and Catherine Newton. They switch bodies. He's a serial killer, and he's about to kill her. And then in the middle of the kill, instead of her dying, she becomes him and he becomes her. And, you know, we've seen the switching body thing a million times. But
were they pissing in the same fountain?
No, he was stabbing her. In a fountain.
I don't know why I go to that movie immediately.
I was say, that's one of the most forgettable switching places movies ever made. I don't hate it. I mean, I don't love it, but I'll take Ryan Reynolds and Jason
Bateman.
But this looks at least interesting. Vince Vaughn being silly again. I haven't seen him do that in a long time. And having to convince high schoolers that he's a girl. And meanwhile, she's the killer. If nothing else, it's a neat idea that they could it either run its course really quick, like Paranormal Activity, or it could be fun, like Happy Death Day. We'll see how it plays out.
My concern is that it just ends up being a gimmick. But then, I mean, I guess this director, Christopher Landon, does well with gimmicks. I mean, Happy Death Day is a gimmick, but it works because it's a good gimmick. But also, Jessica Roth is a fucking movie star.
Right.
So, Catherine Newton, if she can live up to that, then maybe.
But she's been fairly good in what I've seen her in the last few years.
Yeah.
I think she has that potential as well. And Paranormal Activity was a gimmick that was nothing more than a gimmick, and it kind of fell apart three quarters of the way through the movie, and they made six more or whatever the hell they did. So, yeah, he hits and misses just like everybody, I guess. But I'm at least curious. This is more, might be fun on video or whatever, non-streaming. I got to get used to not saying video anymore. And then obviously there's a Sandler Halloween movie coming out.
I hate COVID, obviously. Everybody hates COVID. But the reason I hate COVID now is because for so long I've had the best possible excuses to never have to see Adam Sandler again. And now, because of COVID.
I will say this. There is an element to what you used to say that him. Maybe I'll disagree with that he didn't try, but he definitely was, I want to go on vacation, take my friends. There was definitely that going on there for a solid string of five or six movies. Once he went to Netflix, it seems like he kind of went back to more of the early stuff, which, again, you didn't like anyway. But it's more on par with the Billy Madison, Happy Gilmore, Waterboy type stuff, which, again, does nothing for you. Does nothing for you. But for the regular comedy fan that doesn't watch a lot of movies, it's seems better than the later Adams. Like, he's trying a little harder, if that makes any sense. But again, it's not going to change your opinion, and nor should it, because it's not a work of art. It's just a work of goofball bullshit. He's doing a voice very similar to Waterboy, and
for fuck's sake.
So, but we'll see how it all plays out. Hopefully, it's not too offensive.
All right. I'm already offended. I've not seen an inch of it, so.
I know. As well you should be. Let's move on to, let's just start out with Rent-A-Pal. Why not?
All right. Rent-A-Pal from IFC Midnight, starring Will Wheaton, among others. I should have had the cast up in front of me, but basically the idea here is this kind of sad sack guy in 1990 decides to, he's taking care of his mother. She's ill and elderly, and he's taking care of her, and he decides to, the one thing he does that is himself, and this is Brian Landis Fulkins is his name. He goes on a video dating service, and he gets all these videotapes of women who get videotapes of him and go back and forth, and hopefully he can find somebody to date. Well, while he's there one day, he comes across this tape called Rent-A-Pal, which features this guy, Andy, played by Will Wheaton. And basically you put in the tape and you watch the tape and you can kind of interact with the tape in a way, in this sort of one-sided fashion where he's definitely having a conversation, but there's obviously a script, and you have to either choose to follow the script or not follow the script, but it's kind of creepy and eerie anyway. And boy, I love this movie. I really did. These two guys, Will Wheaton and Brian Landis Fulkins, are exciting to watch together. And the direction here by a guy named John Stevenson, who's in he's the writer director, his first time out in a feature. All of it really works. Like, they come up with a really great atmosphere, a really terrific look for this movie. It's very distinct. The setting is absolutely perfect, and the growing tension throughout is phenomenal. There's a real strong turn of the screw going on throughout this, where you're kind of wondering, is the tape sentient or not? And really, you never really come down on either side. I come down on the side, I guess, I don't think it is. At the same time, there's an element of it that kind of seems like it. I love the balance that they strike between whether or not it's just Fulkins' character is going crazy, or this tape is kind of sentient and pushing him towards being crazier and crazier. The way this develops is just fantastic. He finally does meet a woman, and for some reason, this guy on the tape, Andy, has included a segment of the tape where he's yelling at him and berating him for having a girlfriend, which is a weird inclusion. Which, again, it's one of those things, though, that is that on the tape or is that not on the tape? You don't know.
Right.
How crazy is this guy that bought the tape? That is such a fun thing to play with, and this movie plays with all of that so very, very well. I was entertained throughout. I was fascinated throughout, and by the end, I was gripping at the end, and it was really exciting. I love this movie.
Yeah, I liked it quite a bit as well. Watching him go in and out of kind of, like, he's gradually getting crazier and crazier, but he's also, you know, he comes back to reality. Whenever he gets into the tape, they do a pretty good job of, at the end of the movie, kind of showing you what the tape actually says, I thought, and it's just the way he's translating it. So I don't know. You got the unreliable narrator issue of it with Andy, or is that his name? Andy is Andy on the tape, or is Andy the guy? I can't remember.
Andy is on the tape.
But anyway,
David is David, the guy. Brian Landis Fulkins' character is David.
Yeah, it's just fascinating to kind of watch him go in and out of this mentally unstable place. And then when, you know, the third act hits and it starts going, like, real crazy, it's terrifying. It's kind of fun to watch in a horror movie sense. It's a really, you kind of see it coming, but at the same time, when you put it in, you don't know how, where it's going to go. And it's a good watch. It reminded me of a movie called Cheap Thrills a few years ago that I liked a lot. I like it a little better than this one because there's this sense of reality at the end when because like you said, he goes in and out of this mental illness, and a lot of people who suffer from that do. There's times where you're just when you're normal, and there's times where you're not. And you know, the end of that movie, all of a sudden he's normal, and it's just like, oh, what the hell just happened? In this one, it's more more they play for the horror, which is really it works as well. Just it's a mm-hmm. I really think people will like this a lot if they give it a chance. You watch the trailer. My wife wasn't really into it, so she didn't want to watch it. I think she would have liked it in the end because it's not – you can't really show too much in the trailer. Mm-hmm. But it's worth checking out. I think people will enjoy it. It is definitely a thriller and a borderline horror movie. There's some funny moments in it as well, but I would – I think it's definitely worth checking out.
One thing I want to point out, you know, I wrote this thing about the Wretched a while back about this thing about a corkscrew. And this movie has a similar thing with a pair of scissors. But this movie is a demonstration how to do that so perfectly, that fake out and that setup so perfectly. The same thing that they fail at so miserably in The Wretched, they take that and they do it absolutely perfectly. The direction is so brilliant. You don't know who has the weapon in that moment, and it's terrifying for a second before you find, okay, great, okay. Yeah. the pitch fucking perfect piece of direction. I love that.
Yeah, definitely highly recommend this movie. And then while you're at it, go watch Cheap Thrills, because that's fucking awesome too. anything else on Rent-A-Pal before we move on?
I really love it a lot, and IFC Midnight is doing a hell of a job.
All right, let's kind of... We're all over the place this episode. Let's go to the social dilemma. I wasn't positive this was going to be on the show. My wife made me watch it for... I mean, I got kids that are getting into social media now, and so she wanted to watch this a lot. It's, you know, all the rave on Netflix anyway. Everybody's watching it like, oh, my God, what are they doing to us? Meanwhile, being on their phones the whole time they're watching this movie. But you watch it, Sean. What'd you think?
Yes, The Social Dilemma features a number of interviews with tech insiders who talk about the ways in which tech companies are manipulating our lives to try and keep us online more and doing more on things online. And I guess, Bob, we're part of the problem, you know, keeping people in front of their phones or whatever device they're listening to us on.
Yeah. Sorry about that.
We're part of the Matrix. We've been paid off by Google to get you guys to keep listening as long as possible. And we've got some ads coming up for you to listen to. So,
yep, we get 10 bucks a month.
this is an interesting documentary, and I think it does at least at the very least it offers a few solutions that I think are common sense solutions. If you're common sense in the terms of if you're somebody who's aware of what's going on, then it becomes common sense. Early on, I was kind of put off by just the kind of repeated, you know, doomsday kind of notions that they right. keep pushing on us, and this idea that everything that you do is being manipulated and basically taking all the blame away from the people. Like, it's your fault if you can't put your phone down, dude. Right. I know that sounds kind of naive, maybe. I don't know. I think you can put the phone down. I think we're more capable of putting phones down or stepping away from computers or devices than we give ourselves credit for. I think, yeah, of course they're trying to build ways to reach us and nudge us towards, you know, doing this thing or giving them this impression. And they certainly have every reason to want to do that. And they've developed a science around it. I get that. At the same time, I can't abandon the idea of personal responsibility in that. And I, that's that borderline sort of that loose libertarian thing that's always been at the back of my head for years is just kind of rears its ugly head when I think like that. But I don't see it as this big Machiavellian thing overall. I think it's just the way that business has evolved.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even think it's that bad in some levels. You know, it's mm-hmm. I mean, it's sometimes it's kind of like, well, I mean, I guess you could say, well, where's this going to go? And everybody jumps to 1984 and blah, blah, blah. But I mean, if you're a business, why wouldn't you use every advantage you can to get someone to buy your product? Mm-hmm. I do see the addiction element of it. At the same time, you know, the only way you can break addiction is you have to break it yourself. You mm-hmm. know, if And I mean, I don't know. So it is. It does kind of come back on you, even though it's not easy. Addiction sucks. I don't know. I wasn't the whole doomsday stuff. More than anything, it's the politics stuff, which they didn't. It wasn't as much about that as it was the business side of it. And I mean, it was a little bit, I guess. But I don't know. I kind of feel like I knew everything this documentary was already telling you. It was just now they're telling it from the people who are actually doing it to you. Mm-hmm. So
I thought the stuff at the end was strong. The idea about the types of things that you can regulate that would make this business a little bit more above board. I thought that was, I think those seem like I said, common sense solutions that, you know, even if you're a tech company, you might be annoyed by that. They're also something you could probably support if you had to, if somebody were to actually put your feet to the fire on it. I thought that kind of stuff was good. The stuff where people keep saying that you're being manipulated and everything you do is counted and tracked, and like, that's kind of the bargain you made when you did this.
Yeah. We kind of knew that going in. I mean, maybe not going in, but we knew it eventually. And if that at that point, if we wanted out, we could have got out. So I'm not like, I don't feel, to me, more than anything, I laugh when, you know, I see some ad pop up over and over again because I talked about it or, you know, right. I clicked on it, and rather than get scared by it. But I'm also, at the same time, I'm not on Facebook a lot, as you can tell by our page. So I don't know. It's
I have a friend, my friend Brad is utterly terrified of these things. Anytime he talks about something and then an ad pops up on his Facebook, he wants to move out to Montana and get a cabin in the woods with no electricity. I'm like, dude, calm down.
I want to do that just for the scenery. I went to Colorado like twice on vacation. I'm like, this is the most amazing thing ever. I just want to be here all the time. I don't give a shit about, I mean, if I have social media, I have social media. It's one of those things where we're all in this together at this point. So it's, you know, I don't know. I guess the problem I have with the documentary is by the time it got to those good ideas, I was bored. And so I was kind of in and out my paying attention. When I told you I was watching this, was before I watched it. So I feel, but by the time I got to the end, I was just kind of not paying attention anymore. So I don't really actually know what they even said because the movie bored me. So I think that was more of a problem with the documentary.
Yeah, the narrative elements of the documentary were weird. I thought they were interwoven very strangely. There's this 14-year-old kid who's being manipulated by a company that has like this AI. This AI of the guy from Mad Men, I guess, who's manipulating this kid's entire life to keep him on his phone, I guess. And I've got an 8-year-old goddaughter. She's on her phone pretty regularly, but she's also off her phone just as much as she's on it. And, you know, there are times when we'll play, you know, we're on FaceTime for an hour playing, you know, Roblox, but at the same time, there'll be an hour where we're just coming up with these incredible imaginative stories and characters in her head that have absolutely nothing to do with our phones. And we're not on the phone. We're on a phone with each other, but we're not actually, you know, online, you know, seeking out, you know, anything, playing a game or anything. So the imagination is still alive and well, and you can choose what you consume and don't consume.
Yeah. And I'll even like my son's vocabulary has improved quite incredibly, really. Part of it's watching Dr. Peabody and Sherman, but the other part of it is the interaction he's had on social media, playing like Roblox and other, and maybe, and then watching the YouTube videos about Roblox and Fortnite and Minecraft and all this crap. I don't know. Is Roblox worth getting on? Everybody's telling me I should. I was always making fun of all my kids for being on it, but
I'm like, kind of addicted to the game Adopt Me.
So are my kids.
It's my favorite little pastime because I like raising pets and I like to design houses. And they've got a wonderful program for designing homes. I designed an entire apartment building and then made a TikTok about it just for my goddaughter, and she just loved it. She was blown away that her Uncle Sean could do that.
Yeah, my daughter and her friend, they were on FaceTime doing, and then I had Roblox going at the same time, and they were like, all right, you have to vote which one's the better house. I'm like, I'm not going to start a fight between you two. But you're right. You can do something, and then you can make it, like, I don't really, they kind of were going over the top. There was like party rooms and unicorn rooms and all sorts of. I don't know how realistic yours was or more fun yours was.
It sounds a lot like Adopt Me. You can have. Oh yeah, you can do an entire unicorn themed room.
Oh, it was definitely Adopt Me. They play that nonstop. But the thing that the main reason why
I gotta tell this.
Go ahead.
I gotta tell this story because this is so weird. So this is the weirdest thing that's ever happened to me online. I was playing Adopt Me by myself without my goddaughter just because I wanted to, because I find it entertaining. I'm running around. You could be a baby or a parent, right? But if you be a baby, you make more money so you can build your house or buy your pets or so on. So I'm a baby and I'm running around with my pet and I'm at a campground and we're camping and this person walks up and picks me up and they're carrying me off. And they carry me behind a cabin, and they lay me on the ground. My character's laying on the ground, and then all I see is just this person who picked me up. She just types the words out, stab, stab, stab.
I thought she's going to change your diaper.
No, she's just murdering me.
Do you actually die in this game?
No. I mean, she couldn't kill me. I just jumped back up and walked away, but...
I mean, better than doing it here.
People can just walk up and pick you up, and if you just let them, they can just be your parent for a while, and you can just let them carry you around. It's weird.
Yeah, I mean, I can see this rent-a-pal thing working its right, way exactly. into these type of games. Oh man. Yeah, I haven't gotten into that one yet. I have a TikTok account only to one, embarrass my daughter, but to keep an eye on my daughter. But that's, and then I guess main reason we watched this documentary was my daughter, she's 13. So she's at the very early stages of being on social media. Her and her friend were sharing account. Like my daughter had her friend's account on her phone and the password, and her friend had her account and the password. I'm like, this is a recipe for disaster. You need to change your password now and delete her account from your phone. And she didn't understand why that was a big deal. And you know, there's these weird anonymous things through Snapchat that kind of were creepy to me. You know, you could just ask each other questions, and there is a way to do secret bullying and stuff. There was nothing horribly bullyish on there, but there was definitely sexual stuff that she wasn't comfortable with. She was annoyed that people were asking her these dumb questions, but it was just like, I don't know. It's you can watch your kids all you want, but it's your friends' kids that not even your friends, your kids' friends. You don't know what their parents are like or whatever, and you know, and I don't know. It's weirdly
it's a lot like COVID. It's like you can take care of yourself all day and make sure that your kids are wearing masks and you're wearing masks, but then the asshole next door doesn't wear a mask and suddenly everybody's going to get sick.
So I have so many locks on her. Like there's time limits. I mean, that's the go-to is grounding her from her phone, and we're regularly deleting Snapchat and TikTok off, and she has to ask to get it back on. So it's, you know, we're doing what we can, but like you said,
yeah,
you just never know what everybody else is doing. And I do want to make note that I'm not, this is totally inside baseball. A friend of mine, we have a little something that happened between us and our kids. I'm not referring to this situation when I'm saying, you don't know what other families are doing. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking more about my daughter's friends from school and stuff. So in the event you're listening, I'm not talking about you. So please don't take this the wrong way. But that story is private and is going to remain private. But it's such a tricky thing with kids. As an adult, you know, I feel like I'm old enough to know better. And if I do something stupid, it's on me. If I get addicted to it, it's on me, and I got to get out of it. You know, if I get addicted to drugs or alcohol, I got to figure that out. I'm fat. I'm addicted to food. It's on me. I got to figure that out. Mm-hmm. So I don't know.
You know, it's funny. I'm thinking about this whole this WAP song that's going around, and it's one that it's highly like. It's a kind of a good song, but at the same time, you don't want little kids listening to it. And it reminded me of this thing I used to do to my niece, Alexa, all the time when she was like a teenager. And I would try and tell her something, and she would just kind of blow it off, and I'll go, it'll happen to you too. And now she's a parent and she's got a little baby, and I'm like, it's happening, isn't it? You don't want her listening to that stuff.
Well, it's what's funny to me is to this day, I mean, obviously right now because of COVID, but if we go to a karaoke night, obviously I'm not performing because I don't like attention. And I have no idea if I can sing, but I'm never going to find out because if you don't try, you never fail. That's kind of how I look at things. I don't want to fail. Anyway, my wife sings this song. It's Rob Schneider's daughter did a cover of it. It's something about looking or masturbating or being eaten out or something like that. I mean, it's a famous song. If I sang it, you'd know it, but I'm not going to sing it, so you're not going to know it. Anyway, there's a TikTok right now of all these 40-something mothers listening to WAP and being all disgusted. And then the kids are like, what do you listen to? And then it flips over to that song, which is equally as disgusting. And but you know what? Who cares? I mean, I can't go back and look at the – I grew up on 80s hair metal, and there was nothing more misogynist than that. And
oh, I listened to Two Live Crew. I can't NWA, Two Live Crew, that was my thing, listening to that at 13, 14 years old, being a rebel.
And then if you go back to our favorite bands of the 70s, all of them would be canceled if their stories came out. I mean, they were legit dating and marrying teenagers. So, like, all of them, all of your heroes from all the greatest bands of all time were with teenagers at one point.
Oh, God.
And we just blame Roman Polanski and everybody else gets away scot-free.
It's just, not the hero we want, but the hero we need, Roman Polanski.
I just, I'm guilty. I turn a blind eye. They're my heroes too. Steven Tyler, Ted Nugent. Ted Nugent's not a hero, but you know, they're all with teenagers and it's, it's gross. I can't sit here and listen to this. No, I can't get mad at women writing songs about sex.
I can't. No, bullshit. I would never. I totally respect Cardi and Megan. Good for them.
And I'm as intimidated as hell to be near them. I don't know how you could possibly live up to that. Good luck to whoever they date. Measure for Measure.
Let's talk Shakespeare, shall we?
Like I said, we're all over the place this episode.
Measure for Measure stars Hugo Weaving as a crime boss in this corner of Australia that's just this basically this high-rise area. Very beginning of the movie, he and his criminal enterprise have just kind of been dipping into methamphetamine sales, and this comes back to bite them when one of their customers flips out and has this kind of goes on this racist killing spree where he's just looking for anybody who's not white and just trying to kill him and shoot them right there in the yard. But out of his mind on meth, one of Hugo Weaving's henchmen gets there and kills the guy just before he's going to shoot this Muslim girl who then meets this boy and they begin to fall in love. His name is Claudio, and they have this wonderful love story going on, but she happens to be the sister of another crime boss who runs a gun syndicate and also is a hardcore Muslim. So the idea of her dating this white guy is not going to go over well at all. He makes sort of machinations to get the white guy even thrown in jail for a crime he never committed. Like, it's just awful. So he ends up in jail and she's trying to get him out. And she's also talking to Hugo Weaving and trying to get him to help her, but he's kind of trying to retire, but the guy he's handed off his kingdom to is wanting to stay in the meth game instead of just going back to selling weed, and that's causing all sorts of tension, and everything is just there's this kind of grand tragic romantic quality to everything that happens in this movie, and I really enjoyed a lot of this movie. The quality here is it's very Shakespearean. It's kind of the drama is kind of broad, but the characters themselves are actually rather grounded and very of the moment. And they're using, you know, the Shakespearean sort of idea of tragedy as opposed to the more broad strokes of tragedy that you would see on the stage. But I loved that. I love the touches, especially the idea of the Muslim character is so well drawn. As somebody who's fallen in love with this guy, she can't escape the fact that she's in love with him, and she's going to do whatever it takes to try and be with him at the expense of, you know, losing everything, which, you know, that kind of love is inspiring. And I like this movie.
I think this looks really good. This is one of those where, you know, I am married and we watch trailers for all these movies and she didn't want to watch anything for this week's podcast. So I had to do a lot of it on my own, on my phone or at work on the iPad on after hours, not during my regular work hours. So if my boss came in on Saturday, worked for 5 hours and watched 2 movies, but this was the one that missed out, but I think it looks really, really good. It was just, I really wanted to see Randa Pal and Nail in the Coffin. So, and I had to see the classic. So this one was the one that missed out. Instead, my wife made me watch this horror movie called Z, which is really bad.
I've never heard of it.
Yeah, we had to pay a little more for it because it was a newish release, but it's basically about a kid who's got an imaginary friend named Z. Starts terrifying the mom and the mom really, and then it turns out it was her imaginary friend as a kid, and then it turns out it was real, but then it turns out it was in her head, so she has to take care of it, so she kills herself, but then she doesn't finish the job, so now she's living as a vegetable and this thing lives on forever. So that's your movie.
That sounds terrible. That sounds like a fucking awful horror movie.
Sounds like your everyday horror movie.
It sounds like, yeah, that should have came out in January of 2019 or something, like,
and it might have. you know, or maybe it was going to come out next January, but they're like, you know what, let's just get it on video now. It was one of those movies.
Is there anybody in it?
Nobody I recognize. My wife was like, is that the girl from 24? I'm like, the Mary Rice Cup or whatever the hell her name was? And I'm like, no, that's not her. She's kind of a famous comedian now. Somebody, I don't know who that is. So, no, I didn't recognize anybody in it. I mean, it looked like a January release, like it would have gone to the theater. It was that kind of quality. But it was just kind of, that's the kind of crap me and my wife aren't. She's not as into movies as I am. It's going to be hell on earth trying to convince her to watch Raging Bull and Goodfellas this week. But maybe my son will be up for it. Luckily, I've seen him a million times. It'll be easy, but... But I thought Measure for Measure looked really good. It was just the one that missed out.
I recommend it. It's a solid, well made film with, you know, a combination of modern drama, romance, and classic Shakespeare.
Yeah, it looked fantastic. Nail in the Coffin: The Fall and Rise of Vampiro.
This is a documentary about the wrestler Vampiro, and Vampiro is not somebody I was all that familiar with outside of his time in the dying days of World Championship Wrestling. He came in and was this, you know, spooky sort of character who had this vampire gimmick, and he was interesting to look at, but he was never really very compelling to me. I had no idea who he was, and WCW did an awful job of introducing him, because apparently in Mexico, he was one of the biggest stars in the world. Like, in Mexico, he's a god. He was this kid who showed up at the age of 19 with this look and the willingness to just get beaten down for several years. And women just loved him. They just loved the look of him, this romantic vampire look. And they named him Vampiro Canadiens. And they made him their hero. Opposite Conan, who he was the guy that Conan was going to beat, basically.
And they, in real life, hated each other, which is why why he failed in WCW, because not to go off track, but I'm going to go off track because I like wrestling. If you weren't part of that Hulk Hogan group, which Conan was, you kind of got forgotten about. They kind of buried you, or you moved off to the side and never got to fulfill your potential, and that's kind of what happened to him here. Conan was part of that boys club, and Vampiro never really got a shot.
Yeah. This touches on that, but it doesn't go too deeply into that. It kind of ventures there a little bit, but for the most part, this is actually about he and his daughter and his life now, where he's in this position where he's in his early 50s. He's still wanting to, you know, be in the ring, but at the same time, he's taken a lot of damage. He's done a lot of damage. He's done a lot of things over the years that has done a lot of damage to himself. He's not particularly in the shape that he should be wrestling anymore. And he's got a tremendous mind for being behind the scenes. And he's really been an amazing director down in Mexico, putting the matches together and putting the action on television down there. And that seems like that should be the avenue that he takes, but there's something that keeps driving him to get back in the ring and take another bump. And the thing about it is that throughout the movie, if you're somebody who's familiar with patients who have degenerative memory disorders, you can kind of sense throughout. There's this strong indication that you can see that speaks his ill at ease quality. He doesn't relax ever. And that's because a lot of the times he's kind of unsure about reality. He's unsure about his own memory, unsure about what he's been doing for the most recent moments. And he can still recall things well, but you can sense that things are beginning to slip, and right. he's definitely feeling a lot of anxiety about that. And that's part and parcel of people who have early onset Alzheimer's, which we find out at the end he has. And it's to me, I was broken up about that. It was really, as much as it can't be surprised by it, considering all he's put himself through, it was still, it's a tough blow when you see that actual diagnosis come in. And he says he's fine. Like, he interacted with me on Twitter the other day and was saying that his life is great, that he's in college, that he's living the dream. I hope that's true. At the same time, what I know about Alzheimer's from just my job, and interacting with people who work with those patients, I have them on my radio show pretty regularly, and there's hopeful stuff and there's a lot of sad stuff.
Right. There's things you can do to delay it, but eventually it's going to hit you, and like when it's going to go full blown. And
right.
Hopefully he's doing those things. And the weird thing is, it's not like the wrestler where he didn't have a good life. And it wasn't like he was broke. He had right. a nice house. He had a good life. He had a good job. And when you listen to him talk outside of wrestling, he says things that are the polar opposite of the way he acts when he's there producing and getting in the ring. It's like he hates it, but he can't get away from it. And so there's definitely a love-hate thing he has with wrestling. Mm-hmm. It was just fascinating because it's the wrestler. It wasn't that movie as a documentary. It was its own thing. And I don't know. It was really fascinating. He had guys that he really had a lot of his enemies in this, like him and Jeff Jarrett, and they're in there talking. Conan was on it, was featured prominently, at least maybe not as a talker, but he was in it as a fighter. But Jeff Jarrett and him, I mean, there was things where it was just like, if I'm Jeff Jarrett, I don't know that I sign off on being in this.
That
movie.
Got real, didn't it? It yeah. got very real.
And and it's wrestling, so you never know what's a work and what's not, or what's real and what's not, but it looked pretty real to me.
I was fascinated, too, by seeing Karrion Kross, who was most recently the NXT World Champion on mm-hmm. in the WWE. Great friend of Vampiro's and one of his top guys down there in Mexico. And again, there's just something I had no idea about his background. They just kind of touch on it a little bit, and seeing what a really amazingly cool guy he is.
Yeah. All I really knew about him was I didn't know anything up until probably recently where, he got all those shoot interviews online and then all the wrestling mm-hmm. podcasts, he's been on a couple of those. And that's kind of when I started to realize he was a bigger deal than I thought. But this movie does a really good job of, kind of showing you how big he really was. Mm-hmm. And really there's really no reason behind it other than his look, which and the timing, the look and timing, it was kind of all that there was. But he went with it, and it's kind of an impressive story. It's heartbreaking, mm-hmm. But I don't know. I enjoyed it quite a bit.
The best of these types of documentaries are ones that capture lives that are incredibly unique, and this is an incredibly unique life. As much as people write it off as a wrestling story, this is a very human story and a very human character at the center that I think even if you're not a wrestling fan, you're going to find him to be a fascinating figure to watch.
I think a lot of these wrestling documentaries, if non-wrestling fans watched them, would actually be quite surprised with how good they are. And in watching some of these, it kind of bumps me out about The Dark Side of the Ring and how kind of disappointing those were.
Yeah, yeah.
A couple of good ones, but for the most part, it was just... they all kind of suck.
They kind of seem cheap now when you watch this stuff.
Right. They have an agenda going in and they want to tell mm-hmm. a certain story and then you kind of lose the main story. And I don't know. It's a bummer. But this one, you're not going to watch it if you're not a wrestling fan. But if you happen to, I think you might actually like it.
give it a chance. You know, I would hope that some people would have an open mind enough to at least look at this, because it is such a tremendous human story as opposed to a wrestling story.
Definitely.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the main event for the linear, legitimate, and universally recognized Undisputed Classic.
Key Largo.
Key Largo, 1940-something. I forgot the date. 48, but, 1940, so Lauren Bacall, Humphrey Bogart, and directed by John Huston, who, of course, is the subject of the movie White Hunter Black Heart, which came out 30 years ago this weekend, which we'll get to. The Key Largo stars Humphrey Bogart as a soldier who travels to Key Largo in the Florida Keys to see the family of a soldier that he was in the war with who died, and kind of tell them, kind of help them get a little bit of closure about his story. And while he's there, he finds that they own a hotel down there at Key Largo, and there are these figures at this hotel who are shady. They're obviously they're gangster types, and they certainly rub him the wrong way right away. And what's going to play out is that these gangsters there in the midst of this hurricane that's coming in, and there's a drama about some Native Americans who've been accused of a crime, or there are cops trying to arrest them. And these gangsters are obviously very suspicious of the cops. Then you've got this whole dynamic between Bogart and Bacall that's developing, and this wonderful character of the father of his war buddy, who's just this terrific character, who's kind of his arguments are kind of charging the whole thing with a lot more drama because he's very angry about this whole situation. This movie is about, you know, power dynamics and about, you know, dialogue and about character choices and the way those things can be incredibly dramatic all, you know, in basically just in three different sets and over a period of nearly 90 minutes. It's fascinating because there's not a lot of action in this movie, but there is so much action in these characters and this dialogue and their interaction with each other. Edward G. Robinson plays the big gangster at the heart of it all, and he's a very creepy, disgusting character who's easy to hate. And Bogart's kind of he's the good guy, but he's also not like he's not an anti-hero by any stretch. He's not a criminal, but at the same time, he's got less than heroic qualities too. And I really love the color that he brings to this character. He wants to challenge Robinson. He wants to punch him in the face. He wants to kill him. But at the same time, he also is kind of out for himself and doesn't want to get involved. And I love that conflict that he plays so very, very well in that classically Bogart way. I think Bacall is a little underutilized in all of this. But you know, she's also, you know, this is still relatively young into her career. But unlike, I think The Big Sleep used her a lot better than this movie does. But overall, I really loved this movie. Like I've loved pretty much anything we've ever done with John Huston and Bogart. They work so incredibly well together.
I'm going to say I like this movie, and here's why. Well, every time I go back to this movie, because I don't, like, I know the names, John Huston, Humphrey Bogart, you know, Gene Kelly, all these, you know, Lauren Bacall, all of them in all these different movies, and I'm obviously leaving out names, but I never went back that far. I always, before I started this podcast, I kind of stopped at the late 60s, early 70s. That was kind of where movies started for me. So going back to these, it's like you want every movie to be Casablanca. And so I have to, you know, I'm always looking for that. And then a lot of times Jimmy Stewart will come out and surprise the hell out of me and it'll just go its own direction, be its own classic movie. This is a very good movie in the way that like Ocean's 11 is a very good movie.
Yeah, but yeah, like a up, commercial sort of
right,
thriller,
but you put
yeah.
up against Gone Girl or something like that. And I, you know, so you're in your, I'm in my own head watching this movie as opposed to enjoying it for what it is. But as I got into it more, it's definitely a very good movie. You know, it's, I'm glad I saw it. I think people will like it. It's just sometimes not knowing what you're, when you bring in pre-existing ideas to what you're going to see, you got to fight yourself the first half of the movie to get out of your head. And a lot of times it happens naturally when the movie's just a fucking classic like Vertigo or something like, you know, over the, you know, its own thing. And then, but when it's a very good movie, you just kind of got to let it be a very good movie. And then when you're done, you got to almost go backwards and talk about it like we are now. And that's when I start to really appreciate movies like this as opposed to when I'm watching it. So I do think it's very good and people should see it. It's a fun watch. It is impressive when you think about just the three sets. Mm-hmm. I love talking movies, just dialogue. And, you know, a movie like Ocean's 11, there's not a lot of action in that either. And, you know, you got the Soderbergh and Clooney do things a lot together. And then you also got this kind of a great big cast. It really is. I don't know. I don't know what went wrong with movies in between now and then, but just at some point, I don't know.
Not to say that I can answer that, but I think they're part of it. I think part of it is budget. I think having too much money takes away. You said this a lot. It takes away from your creativity in many ways when you have an unlimited amount of money to do. You know, oh well, I can do the CGI explosion of the boat, so I want to do that, as opposed to setting up a scenario where, you know, Bogart has to manipulate the scene into a place where he gets to shoot somebody. You can just blow up the boat. Right. They can't blow up the boat here. They're going to have to figure another way out. And that's this movie in a nutshell, is that they have to figure out a way to make this series of dialogue pieces dramatic. And they've got to do that using the character dynamics and the backstories that they can develop, and just the personas of Edward G. Robinson and Humphrey Bogart. And those have to carry the whole crux of the drama. And you don't have, you know, CGI explosions to fall back on, or a bigger budget to do other things, you know, to buy more sets or to take it in a different direction. You have to be a little bit more creative and a little more thoughtful.
Well, then the other thing too that is, like, I figured in 1948 they'd get wrong, and maybe they did plenty of times, but these weren't white people playing Native Americans, you know, which was something I was kind of getting myself ready for. Because I like to read about what these movies are about before I watch them, so I can try to get in the right headspace. It's just so hard for me. And it's sad that that's impressive to me. But, you know, later on, a few years down the line, when they're not. So, and maybe it wasn't happening then, too. I don't know.
Houston's different, though, as we see in the movie that was made about him. He was a guy who he could be like horrifically like racist and say awful things, but he also acted in a way that was very inclusive. Like having actual, you know, Native Americans be in the cast, having actual Seminole Indians in the cast of this movie, or when he sees injustice towards Africans while he's making African Queen, he's like, fuck you, leave him alone. Like, but he's going to say, like, I'm taking the side of the racial slur.
Right.
Like it's the complexity of Houston in that way, is like he really respected Native people, as horrible as he could be towards them in some or about them. He did respect them and want to and care about them. Like he you could sense that he really identified with the Temple character, the older gentleman in the movie. You could sense that was kind of his voice in that moment, where he's speaking on behalf of America against crime and but also in favor of these, you know, Native Americans that he wants to help. And I also love that little tinge of drama at the end that's kind of left hanging, where it's like this poor guy, you know, his reputation, he made his reputation with these people in being caring about these people. And he loses that to these awful human beings who force him to be cruel to them without him even knowing it. And that was kind of this sad sort of dark drama that's happening with his character, and it's only implied, but I felt that deeply.
Oh, for sure. And I guess if I'm going to say to somebody who's like me, younger, wanting to go back and become a movie buff and not knowing how far to go back, the main reason to go back is like what you said, instead of we could blow up the boat, we could just shoot, you know, they got to be creative and come up with it. One, not every story has been told on film yet, so they have not gone for it. But two, the lack of money made them have to come up with more creative ideas, and they didn't have to back themselves in the corner and then cheat to get out of the corner, you know?
But also, there's another aspect, too, and some of it, not to call it laziness, but with everybody being theater trained, they're more prepared to also do something that is basically stagey like this, because you only have the three or four sets plus or three sets plus the boat. They're more prepared to do something that's based solely in the stage because they've all grown up in the stage. So that's an aspect to it. I don't want to give them too much credit.
Right. No, there's definitely, you're going to get more realistic stuff today, I guess.
Yeah.
especially from great directors, but
less stage bound.
But in terms of story, I think you're gonna be shocked by how good the stories are in a lot of these movies. So it is worth going back. I mean, a lot of the stuff I went back to is more bloated, and you know, some of it, you know, I love, as much as I love The Godfather and Taxi Driver and Exorcist and all these movies, but they're overly long and there's a lot in there. I don't know. It's all necessary, I guess, but it's just a different, it's a different era. And it really is worth going back the extra couple decades, few decades, and seeing all these movies, because you're going to get something new that you're not getting today. And I don't know that it's possible to get today at the way we're getting it here.
There's more of a willingness back then to talk about morals in a very specific way, as opposed to today, where you know there's this unwillingness to be. I mean, well, when you try to be edgy, you come off as too edgy, or if you're not edgy enough, you have no edge, and people don't like talking about moral conundrums. And back in the day, you know, in the 1940s, that was everything. Coming up with, you know, complicated moral characters like what Bogart plays, where Bogart's not a hero, but he is a hero, but he's not a hero. and that whole thing about him telling the story about his buddy who died, and Bacall says to him, he told me that same story, but he said you were the one who was in the tower and he was the one back there. And that was interesting. Like this, he doesn't want to be a hero. He wants to be out for himself, but at the same time, he does have these heroic tendencies. That type of little detail that they had back then about these moral conundrums and creating these complex characters, I think we put less thought into that today because we can do so much more dynamically with the camera and with the visuals, that we can kind of dazzle people a little bit more, and we forget those little niggling little details like that.
Yeah, but if you freeze frame some of these shots, even though there's only a few sets, they're like so pretty you could put them on your wall. You know, that's neat about this movie and this era. A lot of these, they're actually great shots. So they're, again, it comes back to that less is more approach, I guess. But I don't know. It's give a chance. These are great movies. I'm just talking to my younger self. Sorry. All right, 1990. This is the era that I grew up with. We'll start with the former classic that we had on the show, Postcards from the Edge.
All right. I was prepared for the other one.
Oh, no, let's go to the other one. You're right. We should go to White. I don't know. I just had a list here. White Hunter Blackheart. My fault. Because that's what this movie is about.
Right. Yeah, because this is a movie about John Huston. Even though he's called Wilson in this movie, it is a John Huston story. This is based off of a very true story that even Huston himself has corroborated in the past about how when he went to Africa to make The African Queen, the writer of this was actually the guy who was with him, who wrote a book about this particular story and that Huston ended up signing off on. That character here is played by Jeff Fahey. And of course, Huston Wilson is played by Clint Eastwood. And fascinating. What a fucking fascinating performance. I've got this Clint Eastwood in my mind that is very different than who he is throughout much of this movie. This is a very dynamic Clint Eastwood that I really wasn't expecting. Like, he's so stoic and so stiff in my mind that seeing him, especially early on when he's so loose and so funny and so charming, I was like, who is this guy? and the way he speaks, he captures Huston's way of speaking, and it's not comical. It's not like I didn't cringe when he started doing it. I was like, that's how this guy talks. I bought in immediately, and I bought in on the character. I bought in on the mannerisms. I bought in on this, like, for a time there was a couple moments where I actually called him SJW Eastwood, because I just loved seeing him be on the right side of something. It made me so happy, because then of course he says something horrible and I would be reminded that, you know, Huston was so complex, and Eastwood develops that complexity. He dives right into it. He really captures that essence of Huston that was so interesting. He is this guy who was open to so many other people, and yet at the same time he was a hard drinker and not the nicest guy sometimes, but then everybody loves him because he was just this, you know, he was endlessly charming. And listening to interviews with him, he's so open and so charming and so unique. And Eastwood captures that brilliantly. And you don't really get a sense of that from the title of this movie or really what the premise is, which is him becoming obsessed with wanting to shoot an elephant. And I don't necessarily know that the movie pulls off quite the trick that it's trying to pull off with how symbolic the elephant is in the end. But it's successful enough in the other aspects, in the portrayal of Houston, and especially in Eastwood's performance, that I didn't get myself too caught up in how I don't feel like the ending paid off enough. Like, I didn't feel that dramatic punch that I wanted to from that line, White Hunter, Black Heart. I wanted to feel that more dramatically. But overall, I was so invested in the character and so interested in him and Fahey as well. Fahey's good as well in this. He really captures his character very well. And he's the moral center who's kind of the sounding board of Houston's character and necessary. And almost kind of like it reminded me of the dynamic of, now I would lose this right now, of course. The Great Gatsby. It reminded me of Sam Waterston to Robert Redford in The Great Gatsby, where Waterston can see what's going wrong and he can see the pitfalls coming, but he knows that Gatsby is going to step in that hole regardless of what he does, and that's the tragedy. And that's what Fahey's character is here, is what Waterston is in that movie, where he can see exactly what Houston is doing wrong and how he's sabotaging himself, and yet he has to just stand there and watch him step into the hole. And that at least that dramatically did land with me as opposed to the elephant stuff.
It's so weird. The two reasons I didn't watch this movie are the two reasons you're praising. So I just got it from the trailer, though. So it's, that's, on me. How many times has anybody ever said Jeff Fahey's been good?
It's been a while.
And then watching Clint Eastwood in the trailer, I was just like, oh, Jesus, he's doing Any Which Way But Loose or whatever. That's what I was thinking.
Really like this movie a lot. And this is a revelation. It's not quite what I want it to be because, like I said, there's this big dramatic beat that's missing overall. But I really like this as kind of a mainstream Hollywood biopic in a way.
Not quite Ninja Turtles.
No, not quite. That movie's still number one.
No, I just watched the trailer, and again, I'm having to, convince my wife to watch something and knowing full well this isn't going to be the one she picks. But I'm watching it, and it's only like $1 to rent on Amazon or $1.99. Yeah. And if I had more time, I would have because of the classic, but I was really like, oh, Jesus, I don't know that I want to. There's a reason I've never heard of this movie before, maybe. But, I could have probably watched it and gotten more context into what I saw in the trailer. So that one's on me. Now we can move on to the former classic, Postcards from the Edge.
Yes, Meryl Streep telling the story of Carrie Fisher and Shirley MacLaine as her mom, Debbie Reynolds. Of course, not a direct one-to-one comparison, but right. The idea here is this is a memoir by Carrie Fisher, which Meryl Streep kind of plays out aspects of her life, her drug abuse and rehab and her complicated relationship with her mother. And it's all very funny and very well put together. This is, of course, directed by Mike Nichols, who's a terrific director. He doesn't always land with me. I don't like a lot of Mike Nichols stuff. I like some of it. I don't like it as much as many other people do, but this is a really solid effort, and he's got a lot of really, because I think it's a really great cast. This is Meryl Streep at her most loose and free and fun in a way that isn't over the top like Mamma Mia. Right. Like it's her able to explore a character and be real and not have to carry the dramatic weight of being Meryl Streep, which is fun, because nowadays. When she's in a movie or in the mid sort of part of the century, like when she was doing Doubt, everything had to be big and everything had to be an Oscar thing. And this is so much looser than that. And I really appreciated that.
I almost like that better. It's because we're so used to the Oscar Meryl Streep, but in some ways this is one of my favorite performances of hers. I don't know. but it's a very good
I agree, movie. Yeah, because he's just so loose. And her dynamic with Shirley MacLaine is so well lived in. They have an insane chemistry that feels like the most realistic mother-daughter characters imaginable. They're just so perfect together. And that final scene in the hospital is just glorious. Just a wonderful scene to the back and forth. Dynamic there, these two people seeing how much they truly do love each other is beautiful. It's beautiful to watch.
Death warrant. I haven't seen this.
I think the engine just fell out of the show.
No kidding. We've been shifting a lot this episode, but now we've. Yeah, I haven't seen this movie since probably 1992, 93. I don't know.
I know JCVD's in it. That's pretty much the only thing I know about it.
It's just like all the other ones he did. All right, let's move on. Okay. There's also Hardware, State of Grace, two different movies.
I tried to watch them. They're not available. They don't exist. So.
Yeah, and then there's Repossessed. I've seen this. What's interesting about this is a movie we talked about a few weeks ago, The Exorcist 3. I think a big reason why that's not as memorable. It's because of this movie, the lack of promotion that they had to do for Exorcist 3. They rushed it out to beat Repossessed. There was just a lot. These two movies coming out the same year probably wasn't good for either one of them.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen Repossessed?
Yeah, I'm familiar with the premise. It's a spoof of The Exorcist.
With Linda Blair.
Yeah, and Leslie Nielsen.
I seen it once when I was a kid, and I thought it was funny. But just oddly enough, this week I'm laying in bed and I'm watching, I'm trying to fall asleep. So I just have something on in the background on my phone. And all of a sudden I hear, "You go to hell, you go to hell." But it's being, and more of a whimper, like, "You go to hell." And I like, what the, you know, I've told the story of my house, quote unquote, being haunted.
Right.
I turn over and my wife's flat on her back. Her eyes are wide open. Like she's staring and she's not blinking and she's muttering or whimpering, "You go to hell." Her mouth isn't moving. Now, she's always had issues with sleep paralysis, like two or three times a year it happens.
Oh, and wow.
It's sounds terrible. I've never had to deal with this, but I don't know that I'd ever want to. But so obviously I wake her up and it ended up being actually the easiest one she's ever gone through. But it was, I mean, it's midnight and your wife's staring straight up at the sky.
You go there.
Yeah, I mean, and I knew right away what it was. So I wasn't scared, but it was just like I was trying to imagine what she was going through. And basically what she was dreaming about, walking through a childhood home and ghosts going in and out of her and her not really thinking anything of it. And then she went to sleep. There was this giant black figure over her face and she was trying to fight it off. And she was just screaming, "You go to hell," but in her dream. But you're half awake, half asleep when this is happening, and you can't move.
Yeah.
So it's, I don't know, it's always, some of them have really terrified the hell out of her. That one, however, thanks to me, because I'm a hero. But just the fact that Repossessed came out this week, it kind of goes hand in hand with that. It, you know, I was able to find a Linda Blair photo from this era. I actually maybe picked the kid one up. I don't remember what I did. I don't know. It just reminded me of The Exorcist.
Yeah. Your wife got repossessed.
Yeah. Or either that or I saved her from getting possessed. One or the other. I should have let her get possessed, and that way I could at least find out if it's real or not. Part of why I haven't got this, you know, one of the shows we had to watch in lieu of like Measure for Measure is some documentary on Ed and Lorraine Warren, because she's obsessed with them. And we're sitting there watching it like for like 5 minutes, and she's like, "You, how can you not believe this? These are like, you know, public officials talking here." And I'm like, I'm not seeing them talk. I'm hearing a recording of somebody talking. I don't know who. I don't really care. So it was, it didn't last too long.
Ed and Lorraine Warren, the biggest con artists on the planet.
Right. I mean, the Amityville Horror has been totally debunked over and over again. So I'd happily buy any of these haunted houses just to prove they're not real. If I had the money.
Amen. Yeah.
All right. That's all the 90 movies, right?
All right.
Yes, I do want to recommend something for people to watch. I think it's important to watch. It's on YouTube right now. It's called In Search of a Flat Earth, and it's by a guy named Dan Olson. He's known as Foldable Human on YouTube, and it begins as him doing a video debunking these flat Earth theories, but he takes it to a different direction where it becomes about QAnon. And if you don't know anything about QAnon, this is something you want to know about, and how flat Earth connects to the extreme right and to QAnon is fascinating and kind of scary, and it's an absolute must watch for anyone.
I thought you were about to promote flat Earth theory. At first I was going to debunk it, but now I kind of believe it.
I've got some pamphlets here. No.
It's funny. I was listening. Oddly enough, it was from a wrestling podcast. The wrestler Daniel Bryan, I don't know who it was on with, but they were talking about the flat earth theory, and I think there's some wrestlers that believe it. And he was like, the reason I think people believe it is because nobody's out there researching, is the earth round? So you're never having to prove the point that it's round. So when someone brings up a good idea, you've never had in your mind to debunk it. So that's how people fall for it and go down that rabbit hole and start to believe it. I just thought that was an interesting point. Anyway, I'll definitely check that out. That sounds really fascinating.
It really is. Yeah. And we need to know more about QAnon. No, you really do. It needs more attention.
And stay away from the Joe Rogan podcast. I've been listening to that.
I'll never listen to that guy. Never.
Whenever any interview podcast, if I like the guest, I'll listen. And like Ron White, I liked him as a comedian, and he was on, and he was kind of making fun of the idea that Hillary Clinton was part of a child sex ring. Mm-hmm. And Rogan was going with him, and then he goes, but some of the stuff's real. And he started, and it was just like, I'm like, I don't know. I understand. I'm all for being skeptical, but that guy he's gotten an audience that's so big that it's kind of scary now. As a person, he's probably fine, but now he's got an audience that I don't think he understands how big it is. And mm-hmm. He's really putting in bad information into people's heads.
He worries me because he's this sort of empty vessel who just takes in everything. And you can't do that as a person. You have to kind of take a look at things ahead of time instead of just letting everybody talk at you all the time. And if you let everybody talk at you all the time, you don't know what's real. And I worry that he at times just doesn't really know what's real anymore.
Well, yeah, every time he tries to prove a point on his show, he's like, Jamie, Google, pull it up on Google. And I was like, well, you can't just, I mean, I can do that, and I can prove the opposite by doing that. And again, I got no problem with acting like that as a human.
Right.
Because it doesn't really matter. But when you have the audience you have, it's just getting more and more, I don't know, it's scary. I don't know. Because he's gotten, like, he just signed a $100 million deal because he went from, what, news radio to this? Like, the biggest.
To MMA to this.
To, like, the biggest podcaster ever. And it's, again, nothing against him as a person or an individual.
No.
That audience is huge.
This idea that there's something called the extreme center is something that really bothers me. That's really a stupid concept.
Right.
And he's kind of right at the center of the extreme center.
I know you're on both extremes at the same time. So just, I'm in the middle. No, you're not. You're at the extreme left and you're at the extreme right all at the same time. I don't know how you did it, but yeah, it's, and then you have him and Adam Curry, like the guy who invented podcasting. I'm just like, ugh. Oh my God, this is horrible. I was wanting this to be great. And I was just like, this is really, really bad. Going into anti-vaxxing, I'm like, Jesus Christ, these are supposed to be like the number one and two guy out there mm-hmm. representing our medium, and it's depressing. Anyway, next week we got The Nest, The Devil All the Time, and Antebellum Maybe. Our classic is Raging Bull in 1990, Goodfellas, along with a couple other small movies.
We're going to completely ignore it because God, Goodfellas is the only one that matters.
Yeah. And that's 6 hours of our lives that we got to put towards greatness, and I'm all for it.
Which is very easy for me, but I've got all kinds of time.
Yeah, my job is just driving me nuts lately, and it's kind of, hopefully I can convince my son to watch these classics. He did run long. Do you have time for Flickchart?
Yeah, sure. Whatever. I'm not doing anything.
All right. Up, Hancock.
Up. Yeah. I don't know why I thought about that.
I did two for a second, and then I'm just like, wait a second. Hancock's as mediocre as it gets. This is kind of weird. Bambi, Jurassic Park.
Jurassic Park.
Have we gotten a live-action Bambi yet?
You know, I don't know. Off the top of my head, honestly.
I could see that coming soon. The Terminal, American Pie 2.
Say The Terminator?
The Terminal.
Oh, The Terminal. Oh, that is fucking American Pie. The Terminal.
Yes.
A Clock. I hate that movie so much.
A Clockwork Orange, No Country for Old Men.
No Country for Old Men.
I agree. Sleepers, Basic Instinct. Two movies that aren't very good that people act like are amazing.
Yeah, no kidding. Sleepers, because I really hate Basic Instinct.
Yeah. I mean, I don't hate it as much as you, but I don't mind Sleepers as much. Chasing Amy, Spider-Man 02.
Chasing Amy.
Agreed. The Karate Kid, Million Dollar Baby.
Million Dollar Baby.
Yeah, if Daniel had died at the end, maybe The Karate Kid.
Just for a second, I thought for sure you might have an issue with the ending of Key Largo. Now I guess we can spoil this movie, but I thought maybe you would be upset that they all didn't die at the end. Like, how is Bogart alive? Come on.
No, I mean, I can. So if the story's good enough, you know, it gets you can suspend your disbelief a little more. It's when you get wrapped up in something that, I don't know, when you're rewriting the movie because you're not as engulfed in it, that's when the movie's not. That's when I'm going to want everybody to die at the end.
Fair enough.
Commando, A Beautiful Mind.
A Beautiful Mind.
I mean, my ideal perfect ending is A Serious Man. That's kind of like the perfect ending to a movie.
It is. It really is. I love that ending.
And the problem is, though, if you did that all the time, then it would become, you know, when the bad guys started becoming the good guys in horror movies or whatever, it would just ruin it. American Pie, Austin Powers, International Man of Mystery.
That's tough. That is a tough one. Wow. Gosh, I don't know which way to go on that.
I tend to lean American Pie for me. Where do you lean?
Yeah, I guess kind of American Pie, just because Mike Myers hasn't done himself any favors over the years.
All right. Reservoir Dogs, The Shining.
Reservoir Dogs.
Get some good director matchups today, though.
I was listening to the Travolta Cage podcast, Nathan Rabin and Clint Worthington, and they did... They put Nicolas Cage versus John Travolta and their careers and line up their movies opposite each other via their timeline. It came up this week. It was Pulp Fiction versus Guarding Tess, which obviously Travolta wins that matchup. But yeah. They were talking about Pulp Fiction and they were addressing that thing that people talk about with Tarantino and his influences. And I thought Nathan Rabin had the most amazing assessment of Pulp Fiction, where he said that, everybody else kind of a copying Tarantino. He wasn't copying anybody. He was sampling like a great DJ. And I thought, fuck, that's perfect. Like, that is absolutely what Pulp Fiction is. All, you know, the elements that you recognize from other movies are him sampling beautifully and taking something that existed and turning it into something so much better. That is so perfect.
I don't like to think of sampling as better.
if you take a sample of something and you make it something else, though, and you turn it into something that's your own and make it original, you can't improve upon it.
I know. I was more of, but I'll still take, like, Walk This Way from Aerosmith and Run DMC, as much as I like the Run DMC version.
I would never compare Walk This Way to Pulp Fiction, though, in terms of work of art.
To each his own, whatever. You can't write a song about masturbating and then have Tipper Gore reference that song. You need to write songs like this when they were doing the PMRC things. thought that was genius. Burn after reading Grown Ups.
Burn after reading.
Agreed.
If only we could burn Grown Ups.
Alien Covenant, big.
Big.
Yes. Mars Attacks, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
Mars Attacks.
Yes. What if it's Mars Attacks, Kingdom of Crystal Skull?
I would have to go with Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, apparently.
Boogie Nights, Hannibal.
Boogie Nights.
Heart of a Dog? Or, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Okay, let's remove that one. Fight Club, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Another director matchup.
Jeez, wow.
I don't even know. was,
I lead Fight Club?
Yeah. Probably. Yeah.
I would watch Fight Club before I watched Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
I think that's as close to the middle as I've ever been, though, between two movies up against each other. Catch Me If You Can, Bruce Almighty.
Catch Me If You Can.
Me, Myself, and Irene, Signs.
Signs.
Did you watch the Jerry Lawler on the Stone Cold session thing?
I haven't yet. I've thought about watching it, but I've been too busy.
I mean, I know everybody's heard about them talking about how much Jim Carrey was a dick on set of Man on the Moon, but they go into that a little more than I've ever seen before. Basically, he just claims that he wasn't channeling Andy Wright, and so it was weird for him to watch the movie. And even when you watch that Netflix documentary, you kind of get that impression. He was channeling whatever he wanted it to be, not necessarily what Andy really was. I still like it.
Yeah, but it's weird, though, when you're ignoring the people who are actually there and they're like, hey, this is actually how it was. When I get that Carrie's trying to bring something original to it and kind of keep it as his own vision, which you want to do. You don't want to be too influenced by outside forces. At the same time, if they're telling you this is how it happened and you're doing a biopic, you should acknowledge that a little bit.
Well, you're doing the biopic. You got Milos Forman directing it, like one of the greatest directors of all time. Jerry Lawler walks up to him and is like, what the hell is he doing? And he's like, I don't know. He's the 800-pound gorilla. I can't control him. How to Train Your Dragon, Back to the Future.
Back to the Future.
Agreed. Race to Witch Mountain, Gremlins. Jesus Christ.
Race to Witch Mountain was actually a really good movie.
I've never seen it, but...
Wait, the Rock version. We're talking about the Rock version, right?
Yes.
Okay, because there's a 1980 Disney version that I would not vote for.
21 Jump Street, Groundhog Day.
21 Jump Street. In a flip?
Yeah, but I...
Here's I think thing. Jump Street's hilarious. I think it's way funnier than Groundhog Day, honestly. And I'm not the biggest fan of Groundhog Day to begin with.
I'm kind of with you, but part of me also understands why people like Groundhog Day, and I feel like they need to be represented. But 21 Jump Street wins the flip anyway. Yeah, I remember as a kid watching it, my dad loving it. I'm like, this is literally the same thing over and over again. What's so cool about this? I love Bill Murray, don't get me wrong, but Bill Murray and Harold Ramis had a huge fight after this because they disagreed on it, so it couldn't be that great.
I find people just try to adopt they try and intellectualize that movie far too much, and it makes me hate that movie a little bit from the way that people try and make it more intelligent than it is.
Yeah.
And whereas 21 Jump Street lives up to exactly everything that it sets out to be, and the laugh per minute on that movie is off the charts. Just they're joking from minute one to the last, and they're nailing it just about every time.
And Groundhog Day may live up to what they set out for, but the audience changed what they set out for.
Yes,
something
exactly.
Else. When they're all, I mean, not that I care about Oscars anymore, but when everybody's like, Bill Murray should have got the Oscar for that, I'm like, okay, you don't know what you're talking about.
it's this faux intellectualism that people have brought to that really bugs me.
Office Space, Beetlejuice.
Office Space.
Yes. Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, X-Men Origins, Wolverine.
Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. Although I do need to edit my X-Men Wolverine review today. Maybe I'll see if I like it or not.
The Mask of Zorro, Memento.
Memento. Love that movie.
Yes. Star Wars, Phantom Menace, The Butterfly Effect.
Phantom Menace.
I hate The Butterfly Effect, so I'll just...
It's a terrible movie. Doesn't live up to its premise at all. At all.
We'll flip for this one, but V for Vendetta, Rocky Balboa.
V for Vendetta.
I hate that movie. I win. Here's the reason I hate that movie. It's kind of like why I don't like Bill Maher's Religious or whatever. I agree with everything they're trying to say, but I feel like it's like trying too much to, I don't know, the whole Bush thing was going on. It was like the metaphor was too thick for me and it just drove me nuts.
Maybe you need a little time away from him and watch it again.
Maybe. But I'm also biased towards Rocky Balboa, so. All right, let's find one more good one to go out on. Although I'm sure I've passed 4 or 5 of them already. This one may at least be challenging. Jaws, Superbad.
Ooh, wow. How do you pick there?
Yeah.
I mean, because I love Superbad. Like, I've got a deep attachment to that movie, but Jaws is Jaws.
Yeah, you're supposed to say Jaws, but I'm with you. That Superbad's kind of our era growing up.
Fuck. I don't know what to do with that. I mean, that's actually a coin toss right there. That is, I could go either way because I could watch both those movies in a minute.
Yeah. All right. We can toss it. I'm having a hard time too. Let's see what George says. Jaws.